KALW.
People are really struggling to survive on a day-to-day basis. Not all of them are as familiar with the political process as other districts.
The city of Richmond is facing challenges with voter engagement, especially in District 1.
There's definitely some conversation to be had in this district as to how that money can be seen tangibly in the district.
We'll hear the concerns and priorities in Richmond's upcoming city council election. Then, what does it take to bring more nature into modern life?
We are, as I like to say, domesticated animals. So for us to go feral, you know, we can't be completely wild, really, not in our generation. You have to learn a series of skills.
It's the next episode of Book It. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Voters will have their work cut out for them on November 5th. To help make sense of it all, we've partnered with Bay Area Newsrooms to bring listeners comprehensive news and elections coverage. And today we're zooming in to Richmond's District 1. Joelle Umanzor is city reporter at Richmond's side. He sat down with KALW's Sunni Khalid to talk about the candidates running for city council seats in the district and to see how they're addressing the top issues of concern for residents there. Here's Sunni.
Could you tell us where District 1 is located in what's considered downtown Richmond? And just tell the listeners who may not be familiar what the landscape is, the population, the demographics are of the area.
This particular district, District 1, encompasses the Iron Triangle neighborhood and Belding Woods. It's just on the west side of town for the most part. What residents would consider central Richmond. The Iron Triangle is kind of bordered by a few of these train lines, and that's where it gets its original name from. And it's on the western part of that 23rd Street corridor that kind of goes through the heart of the city. So a large Black community, a large Spanish-speaking community that lives in this District 1. And, socioeconomically, you know, this is part of the, what many would consider, you know, the lower class, area of town. A lot of folks, according to the census data from 2022, 35% of the people in District 1 make less than $50,000 a year. And I think about half make less than $75,000 a year. So this is definitely a district that, economically speaking, they're trying to get by.
Let's start with the candidates. You've been doing the reporting on all three. Let's start with the first, Jamelia Brown. Tell us a little bit more about her. How does she stand on the issues?
Well, Jamelia Brown, she is a fourth-generation Richmond resident. Her grandparents came during World War II to work at the shipyard. So she has very deep roots in the Iron Triangle. She grew up in the terrace apartments, the housing projects down here on Barrett Avenue. And she really has made her focus on improved public safety for District 1 residents, improved infrastructure when it comes to installing stop signs at certain intersections that might be more hazardous than others, as well as trying to bring back some of the economic resiliency. This particular district on the McDonald Corridor was initially the original retail area of Richmond back in the day before, you know, the pre-Hilltop Mall days in the 50s and 60s. So it was at one point a very economically thriving area in Richmond. She's really championed this idea of having a community oversight committee when it comes to the Chevron money, putting residents in the driver's seat as to where this money could be better used to help residents' day-to-day lives.
One of her two rivals is Mark Wasberg, who is a bit of a political gadfly. You've reported about him at some of the city council meetings. What are his stances and how does he stand out in the field?
He is a very polarizing character, if you will, for Richmond. I mean, if we have to boil what Mark's talking points are, is that, you know, he's very anti-RPA, which is the Richmond Progressive Alliance. And that RPA organization has, you know, slated a lot of their candidates and have made a lot of inroads in terms of Richmond's political state as of right now. They have a majority on the city council. But I think with him, it's almost like an opposite to the status quo that what Richmond has gotten used to. And his platform, I'm not sure that he's necessarily offering as much solutions that, you know, that, you know, voters want to hear, but he does have his talking points that he has stuck by faithfully, and such as not having the city council focus on issues that are like the Gaza ceasefire issue that they had focused on at the end of last year when all the conflicts was starting to arise. He really wants to bring big businesses and retain big businesses. He's kind of harped on his time as a Chevron employee to be like, the city council's not doing enough to keep these big businesses from staying in Richmond. Mark is definitely one of those candidates who you're either going to like him or you're going to hate him.
Both Brown and Wasberg have their sights set on the incumbent, Melvin Willis, who has served 3 terms on the city council. Tell us about him and what has he tried to do to get people to reelect him for a 4th time?
Melvin has really championed himself for renters, for those looking for affordable housing here in Richmond since his start as an organizer here with local housing nonprofits. He's really made that one of his main platform issues is, you know, defending renters, people in low-income housing. And he's done a lot. You know, they passed rent control when he first got onto the city council back in 2016. He's been one of these longstanding RPA city council members who has remained on the body and has voted on very crucial things that are happening in Richmond, whether that be Measure U and the gross receipts tax or that Gaza resolution, which is one of the more broader stuff that the RPA has kind of tackled. But those resolutions, whether you agree with them or not, they have some effect on how people feel about his time on the city council. For as much as some people might say that he isn't as responsive as other city council members, he does make it a point to just be around. And I think that visibility, whether that is him walking up 23rd Street and just interacting with folks he grew up with, because he is also from the area he grew up on, along that 23rd Street corridor, makes him one of the more formidable incumbents that are entering this race.
What are the voters telling you as you make the rounds? What are their concerns?
Residents feel like public safety, wanting to feel safe in their neighborhoods, wanting to not have to deal with impromptu sideshows happening on city streets, and then just the overall cleanliness and quality of life. I think those are the main topics that residents really conveyed when we were out in the streets talking to them.
That was Joelle Umanzor, city reporter at Richmond Side, speaking with KALW's Sunni Khalid. Find all our election coverage at KALW.org/2024elections. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. With all the time we spend between our phones and tablets and laptops, sometimes our lives can feel completely separate from the natural world. And sometimes it's hard to imagine how we could approach reconnecting to it. Next up, KALW's Angie Coiro brings us a new episode of Book It with her guest Jessica Carew Kraft, author of Why We Need to Be Wild, One Woman's Quest for Ancient Human Answers to 21st Century Questions. It's all about returning to our wild roots while existing in modern life. Here's Angie.
Yeah, now Jessica is fascinating. She moved from a common Silicon Valley life, tech job, family, to life dictated by nature, eating what she found, including roadkill, and building whatever she needed. She does warn that if you want to do the same, don't expect to change overnight.
Well, it's I would say it's not something you can just dive into, because there's so much that we are conditioned to in our contemporary society. We are, as I like to say, domesticated animals, right? So for us to go feral You know, we can't be completely wild, really, not in our generation. You have to learn a series of skills, and a lot of it is perceptual. So beginning to understand what you're looking at when you are exploring nature, understanding the basic human skill of tracking animals and even trailing. If you're doing some sort of hunting, you need to be able to identify the poisonous plants, the threats in the environment. You've got to be able to find the foods and medicines there. I mean, it's an entire, basically 12 years of education. If you think about somebody who was raised in a hunter-gatherer group that hasn't had much exposure to modern civilization, it usually takes an individual in that small social clan about 12 years to learn the skills to be self-sufficient.
You have to be in a position of privilege to examine this kind of life, because you have to kind of freedom to let go and go be in the wild. I mean, it's not something everyone can do.
Right. I've always been somebody really sensitive to hierarchy in society. I would have called myself an activist in college. Maybe today they'd call me a social justice warrior, but somebody who was very attuned to the inequity all around me. And yes, it was essential that I recognize that I was in a position to do this, but yet to not do it seemed to be depriving me and my family and future generations of our opportunity to get back to nature, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have privilege, if you have an opportunity, if you're taking it sort of for this good, for this leap, I think it's justified. And then also working to raise awareness about the people who aren't able to do what you're doing. Right. And so the book has a couple of chapters that deal, you know, distinctly with what's happening with Native American populations and African Americans and folks who don't have the resources or even, you know, the information available to them. They're living in a high rise in Singapore. How could they possibly rewild?
Yes.
Yeah. And yet, I think it's also important to say that this is the original, cheapest, most sustainable way to live on the planet. So if, you know, to say that it's a privilege, it's almost an oxymoron.
That's true.
Right? Because I found that I don't need very much income these days if I'm, you know, really living in a wild fashion, because I know where to find what I need in nature, and you're much more resourceful with your lifestyle. You don't have to be ordering from Amazon. You can make the things you need. So yes, it's a privilege to kind of start the journey. And then I think to stay on it, you know, it's just sort of a coming back to where humans always were.
Mm-hmm. You started the book with grabbing a dead fox off the road. And I thought, well, if I'm with her for this, I'll be with her for the whole ride.
But you stayed. Okay, thank you.
I did stay. But, you know, and that's part of availing yourself of what is out there. I mean, in Paleolithic times, it wouldn't have been hit by a car,
right?
Obviously.
Yeah.
But here's a dead animal. It's in a certain stage previous to serious decomposition. Ergo, it can be a food source. And what surprised me about that was you have two daughters. And neither of them was like, oh, no, it's the fabulous Mr. Fox. We have to leave him where he is. Mommy, how can you dare eat him? They were like totally in on it.
Mm. Yeah.
Tell me about your kids, about how they were open to such a thing.
Well, I should set the context, which was that we had just come from an ancestral skills gathering.
Mm-hmm.
So they had been exposed perhaps over like the previous year and a half to people who were taking these kind of trash resources that are out there, things that are discarded, that you can scavenge. And certainly roadkill is part of that. And they had seen, oh, you can make a beautiful pelt out of this. You can make a cap. And they saw these wonderful objects that were made from nature's trash, basically, and things that we consider to be an eyesore on the side of the road. So they didn't have the kind of preconditioning that I think I had when I was like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
And I wanted to start the book that way because it is shocking. It was like, what is this suburban, educated mom of two girls doing hanging out with roadkill and trying to get it in her car? It's just such a crazy thing. And yet I did it. And yet I knew a lot of people who were also doing the same thing. And, you know, it still continues to be a fascination of mine. You know, oh, there's a deer. Maybe I should come back and get it. So there was a period in their life where that was just normal and was something that they knew people were doing that.
That's so cool. But yeah, the other thing that you mentioned in that is you talked about the fact that to see a dead animal on the side of the road for most of us is, oh, I wonder when that will go away.
Mm-hmm.
Not that we see the sorrow in it losing its life that way, but we still are detached enough from it that it's in the way. It's debris. It has no inherent use. And this is so turning that on its head that it's really thought-provoking.
Well, thank you. Good. Yeah. I mean, I know there are some areas of the country where the roadkill is treated as a precious resource. And for instance, Native American communities are on a list that the sheriff can call if they get a desirable animal and they donate that to the community that can then use those resources. So I think attitudes are shifting. They're returning to like, okay, this is an animal that we can scavenge. We can make clothing from it. We can make teepees, a shelter. We can make all these tools, and then we can eat the meat, right? So it's once you shift into that mindset, you see the sacrifice, you know, that this is like a horrible, horrible waste of resources and also waste of life. And it takes on, you know, kind of this higher, I don't know, I guess, spiritual context when you're driving down the road and you see that. I've had an idea to merge my past with my contemporary obsessions. And I'm like, somebody should make an app for roadkill. So, okay, I alert you, there was an elk here or there was a raccoon there. And then local people who are interested in that resource can then go and safely retrieve it, right? Wouldn't that be kind of cool?
That would actually be very cool.
Because I see so much. I'm on the freeways a lot and I can't stop every time. So something like that, I think there are so many ways that we can use what's going on in tech to rewild. And that's one of the ways we could do it.
That's something I had not thought of. But it's also not just about, I'm going to live like a Native American. But living in the wild actually came from any number of societies, including American pioneers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And there's so many different ways to do it. And as an anthropologist, I'm well aware that you cannot make any hard and fast rules about, oh, yes, people eat this and they observe burials this way, right? We have myriad ways to do all of these things. I mean, that's the context we're here in America. And I think there is a danger that a lot of folks who are deracinated, they don't know their own family heritage or their origin. They've lost the stories, you know, at Ellis Island. And maybe that was 100 years ago, 200 years ago. Yet they're looking for a way to authentically connect to this land. And so they see this rich, incredible, and varied history of Native Americans here, and they sort of take it, right? And then we have all of the debates about cultural appropriation, and I definitely get into that in the book. But my point is that all of us, whether the history is 300 years ago or 10,000 years ago, we are all hunter-gatherers in our past, and that is the DNA that we still have. Our minds, bodies, physiology run with Paleolithic code. And so there isn't, you know, you don't need to imitate and you don't need to take or appropriate from another culture. You can explore your own. And there are some, you know, I said, oh, there aren't any rules. But then, you know, there are some basics like making fire, filtering water, finding edible food. All of these apply to every human everywhere. And so learning those skills, I think, is safe. It's fun. It's a way to connect with nature. It doesn't delve into like cultural appropriation and political issues. And so I advocate for that in my book that, that's the way to go about it, is to kind of either explore your own history, your own heritage as far as you can, or learn these basic human skills and connect to the fact that we were all living as wild foragers.
Mm-hmm. Why? Talking about the why, mm-hmm. There are benefits to this that people may not think about. You quoted a study from an anthropologist in the 1970s, mm-hmm. James Larrick.
Yes.
Tell me what he found.
So he went and he looked at the Huarani people, I believe they're in Ecuador, and he was looking at their rates of chronic illness that we sort of take as a given in our society. So things like high blood pressure and diabetes and various cancers, autoimmune conditions. In our society today, we sort of accept that as, oh yeah, some of us are going to get that. Maybe most of us are going to get it. And what he saw was that there is almost zero to extremely low incidence of all of these chronic ailments. Why is that? Well, there are evolutionary reasons for that. When we live in nature, we're exposed to the sun, we're exposed to microbes and parasites. We have continuous social support from birth to the grave. We are exercising every day because we need to go out and find food. We need to go on a hunt. We need to recreate. All of the elements of a healthy lifestyle are incorporated in just the way those folks live, right? And later research in the 90s and early 2000s found that many hunter-gatherer tribes that have not settled down, have not started agriculture, you know, they're walking 17,000 steps a day. They have no alcoholism. They have no, you know, if you mention the idea of suicide and talk about how X percent of American men commit suicide every year, it is unfathomable to them that someone would actually take their own life, because there is this rich idea that you're embedded in your environment, you're embedded in your clan, you have a meaning and purpose to extract yourself from that. I mean, it just seems silly. They almost laugh at it, mm-hmm. right? So all these things that we've normalized in civilization, when the anthropologists go and study and they see it, it's almost like unbelievable that, you know, and of course there are, like you were saying before, don't romanticize. We would all be very uncomfortable if we started living as hunter-gatherers tomorrow, right? Like, that is the absolute reality of it. You have to learn how to put up with all sorts of things that we just don't tolerate anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, for instance, it's what, 88 degrees outside and we're in this air-conditioned studio and I'm so relieved that we're not sweating in the heat. We're not battling flies and ticks and, you know, poisonous snakes. So, I mean, we know that. We know that it's a more uncomfortable life, yet what we have given up in our cozy, comfortable existence here, I think it doesn't make up for what they have in terms of their health, their connection to nature, their sense of purpose, and their social community.
Another continuum in the book is whether this is an act of cultural preservation or whether this is an act of creating new culture. It's not either or. It sounds like, again, it's a melange of both those things.
That's a great observation. I really love that. Yes, it is, because we are so removed from our hunter-gatherer origins that, you know, to reconstitute a nomadic social clan, and a lot of people have actually tried. I might write my next book about this, these sort of failed experiments of wild foraging that have happened. It's just really difficult because our minds are pickled, right? It's like you can't turn it back into a cucumber by our social interactions, by our media, by, you know, all of us do. We have expectations of what romance is supposed to look like because of the movies, because of novels, et cetera. And so to kind of undo all of the cultural templates that we have in our head and then go live as hunter-gatherers, it's really difficult. So I would say absolutely, we're making a new thing. It's a hybrid. And then one thing that I found really interesting in my research was that so many of the folks who are reviving these traditions, whether it's buckskin brain tanning, so using the brain of a deer to tan the hide of it, which is a traditional way. It sounds alarming when you first hear about it, but like that's how Native Americans would tan all their hides. People who revived that in the 70s, also, they referred to ethnographic texts. They were looking at the early anthropologists and, you know, 1800s, 1900s, looking at how they described how the existing Native communities then did things. And so many people are like mining ethnography to figure out, okay, can we use the stomach of a buffalo to transport water? Is that unsafe? I mean, very interesting experiments are going on and entire new sports are being developed, like the atlatl, which is a precursor to the bow and arrow. Over 20,000 years ago, this weapon was developed. It completely disappeared. No existing hunter-gatherer group uses this. And yet it was then discovered by archaeologists and folks started experimenting with it. And now there's like a national atlatl championship.
Wow.
Yeah. So all sorts of cool things are going on, reviving, remixing. And I think it's really exciting.
That was KLW's Angie Coiro with our featured series, Book It. Her guest this week was Jessica Carew Kraft, author of Why We Need to Be Wild, One Woman's Quest for Ancient Human Answers to 21st Century Questions. And if you or someone you know may be considering suicide or is in crisis, call or text 988 to reach the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. We'll have a link at klw.org/crosscurrents. Tune in tomorrow morning at 11 as we celebrate the great and almighty gourd.
They looked around and they saw pumpkins everywhere. So they decided, how about we have a pumpkin festival?
Heavyweight champions at Half Moon Bay tomorrow morning at 11. Today's Cross Currents team includes Demetrius Johnson, Leon Morimoto, Christelle Rahim, James Rowlands, Ganadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salier, Shireen Hadil, Anisha Herjani, Lisa Morehouse, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.